This week on Capitalism, Race, and Democracy.
I am here in opposition to Israel's system of apartheid that curtails Palestinian rights and ends Palestinian lives. A system that my employer materially supports through its involvement with Project Nimbus.
Google workers speak out against the use of Google technology and AI to target Palestinians in Gaza.
We here today are joining the millions of people around the world to send to the United States and Israel the message that the workers of the world are uniting against this atrocious genocide.
Thousands of trade unionists rally for Palestine in California and New York.
While climate change is serious and deserves an immediate action, Somalia is not the climate change poster child that the climate profiteers would like us to believe. Many man-made factories contribute more to the misery than climate change.
International press and NGOs blame global warming for catastrophic flooding in Somalia, but upstream dams, weak Somali government, and poor land use are also causes.
In the case of Guyana, they're not just selling their resources to foreign companies, it's that they've seen large U.S. presence in the region, that they're seeing large Southcom presence in the region, military exercises in Guyana. So it's a country which Venezuela says Guyana is not a sovereign country.
Venezuela and Guyana disagree over who has sovereignty over the Essequibo region, an oil and resource-rich area which Venezuela has claimed since its independence from Spain in 1824. From Pacifica Radio, this is Capitalism, Race, and Democracy, a collective effort by producers from Pacifica stations and affiliates across the U.S. I'm your host, Paulina Vasilyev. Google workers are speaking up and rallying against the use of Google technology and AI to target and murder Palestinians in Gaza. Thousands of people rallied outside Google San Francisco on December 14th. They also talked about the targeting of Muslim workers and retaliation.
Google, Google, you can't hide. We charge you with genocide.
Google, Google, you can't hide.
We charge you with genocide.
My name is Valerie. I'm a software engineer at Google, working on their platforms and ecosystems. And me and so many other Google workers are out here today to protest against Project Nimbus, which is a partnership between Google and Amazon with the Israeli government that provides them with cloud services, including cloud computing power and data centers in Israel, including advanced AI technology such as facial recognition and video analysis.
And there have been other demonstrations at Google. There have been other demonstrations at Google not to work on Nimbus. Why do they continue to do it?
Yeah, well, we're continuing to do this because Google leadership is refusing to listen to us. They have actively fought back against organizers in the past, including Ariel Corin, which is probably the most famous example. But we are determined to make sure to organize together. Yeah, we're determined to organize together because we fought against Google before to not profit off of war, and we're confident we can do it once again.
And there's a union here, Alphabet Workers Union. Are you a member of it?
Yes, I'm a member of the union, and I'm a proud member, and I'm glad they're here supporting all of us.
Is the union supporting this?
The union as a whole has not made a definitive statement on Project Nimbus, but many members are working together with us on the No Tech for Apartheid campaign.
Is opposition to what Google's doing growing in Google?
It definitely is. Even within the wider community, you can see like so many thousands, dozens of thousands have been protesting on the streets. And of course, this is reflected within Google as well. And unfortunately, retaliation against all of these workers organizing against Google has also increased. HR has been speaking with people who have spoken out against this issue and just, you know, retaliate against them, and it's very unfortunate.
They're trying to suppress viewpoints.
Exactly, yeah. And I think the worst part is they're specifically targeting the most vulnerable communities during this time. I remember a story where multiple people were sharing a story through internal emails with their coworkers to talk about Project Nimbus and the Palestine issue. And out of all the ones that shared it, the only coworker that was Muslim was the one that had to talk to HR. And they were accused of being a terrorist supporter.
Are you concerned about this intimidation that's going on against workers if they speak out?
I'm personally not. I'm very proud to stand up against Google and protest against Project Nimbus. But of course, I understand there are many that are, and that is why we're out here, to show that they're not alone and that together, by organizing labor power, we can win as a strong unit together.
Google, you can't hide. We charge you with genocide.
I'm Anna. I'm a Google worker. I'm a member of the Democratic Socialists of America, and I'm here in support of No Tech for Apartheid. I am here in opposition to Israel's system of apartheid that curtails Palestinian rights and ends Palestinian lives, a system that my employer materially supports through its involvement with Project Nimbus. When Google or its spokespersons comment on Project Nimbus, it is framed as a project to, quote, provide public cloud services to help address Israel's challenges within the public sector, including in healthcare, transportation, and education, unquote. Any mention of military use is consistently absent from Google's comments. The Israeli government, however, is far more open about military involvement in Project Nimbus. An Israeli government press release published at the beginning of this year stated in no uncertain terms that the Israel Defense Force, the military that has killed more than 18,000 people in Gaza in 2 months, including over 7,000 children, is among the government institutions that are leading the project. Project Nimbus began in the midst of the Israeli government's rapid expansion of surveillance of Palestinians using a massive database of facial recognition data collected in the West Bank. Last year, reporting in The Intercept revealed that the services offered by Google to the Israeli government include exactly the sorts of machine learning and analysis tools that enable Israel to continue to expand its comprehensive, inhumane system of digital and physical surveillance of Palestinians. Israel's use of sophisticated modern technology in Palestine does not, however, end up surveillance. A recently published article written by Yuval Abraham, based on interviews with current and former Israeli intelligence insiders, reveals the IDF's use of a system called the Gospel, an artificial intelligence system that generates targets for military attacks at an unprecedented, previously unimaginable scale. Many of the targets the Gospel marks for strikes are civilian infrastructure, including residential towers and private homes. The ongoing massacre in Gaza leaves no room for doubt. AI is being used by the IDF as a technological pretense for the killings of thousands of civilians in Gaza. Meanwhile, Google Cloud is celebrating its first profitable year, no doubt in part off of its lucrative contract with the Israeli government, providing the Israeli state with vast amounts of compute power, while the IDF is using artificial intelligence in its killing of thousands of Gazans, amounts to war profiteering and enabling of genocide. That is why, with grief for Gaza in my heart, I am publicly joining many of my colleagues in condemning Google's continued support of Project Nimbus and in calling on Google to drop the project. I also stand here today in solidarity with my fellow Google workers who choose to remain anonymous in their opposition to Project Nimbus for fear of retaliation. Google has a growing track record of retaliation against workers who speak out about Project Nimbus, creating a chilling effect for dissent on the project. And finally, to all of my fellow Google workers, especially those in Google Cloud, I urge you to stand with us and refuse for your labor to be used for the enabling of apartheid, violations of international law, and collective punishment by the Israeli military. Individual workers alone have little sway with their employer, but together our organized collective efforts can be a force for change, for peace, and for justice. Thank you.
Our next speaker is an organizer with the Palestinian Youth Movement. For the past year, he has worked tirelessly to organize against AI-enabled abuses of Palestinian human rights. Please welcome Rami from the PYM.
Is actively supplying the Israeli military with technology that is being used to fulfill the dystopian goals of settler colonialism. By supplying the Israeli military with surveillance tools used to actively target Palestinians, Google is an active participant in Israel's horrific creation of a death world in Gaza. As people of conscience standing against genocide, we demand an immediate end to Google's blood-soaked Project Nimbus contract. I applaud you all for coming out today to support this effort and raising your voices high against genocide. While we have a long paper trail of meticulous documentation of how Israel uses surveillance technology to violate Palestinians' daily lives and right to privacy in the West Bank and Jerusalem, monitoring their digital activity, stopping them at military checkpoints, and storing children's biometric data through a system called Blue Wolf. Boo! However, we did not know how Israel was using AI technology on the ground, in battle, and in combat. In an article published 2 weeks ago, journalists uncovered an AI system called the Gospel. This system can generate targets, up to 100 targets a day, at an unprecedented amount, more than ever possible, and this was done through the use of technology and AI. Israel's AI-powered genocide is being fueled by tech companies like Google, and it cannot go on for one more day. Just a few weeks ago, my Obed, a Palestinian youth in Gaza, was murdered along with her entire family in an airstrike. Allah yarhamha. Before her death, she interned with a Google program and had dreams of developing a platform for people with disabilities to talk and connect. Google is providing the tools of murder for the same genocidal entity that stripped Mai of her future. To this day, Google refuses to publicly or internally acknowledge her death, because then they would be acknowledging the material reality of their $1.2 billion contract with Israel. Shame! Justice for my Obeid and justice for the steadfast Palestinian people!
My name is Noor, and I'm an Egyptian-American and the granddaughter of immigrants. I also work as a data scientist at Google. My name, Noor, means light, and in this time of grief, there is no stronger light than our collective action and solidarity with the people of Palestine. I studied philosophy and data science in university, and one of the most important things I learned was the incredible responsibility we have to eliminate bias in our work. There are dire consequences of failing to do so. For instance, most people know that our prison systems are systematically biased against black and brown people. What do you think happens when you train a model on a racist system without addressing the bias in? You get AI tools like Project Nimbus that perpetuate, that perpetuate the unjust disparities and the violence that was already too present in our society. I work as a data scientist at Google, and I condemn the use of AI for genocide. I condemn the complicity of big tech in supporting AI-powered military targeting. And as long as we are here today, we will stand against anti-Palestinian biases being perpetuated throughout these systems. I condemn the complicity of big tech in supporting AI-powered military targeting. And as long as we are here today, we will stand against anti-Palestinian biases being perpetuated throughout these systems.
Those were voices of Google workers demanding an end to the Nimbus contract and also opposing the use of artificial intelligence for war on the Palestinian people.
صحيت الإيد وطني محتل سرقوا الأرض قتلوا الأحلام احتلوا البلاد طردوا الأجداد
صفقة جاو صفقة جاو صفقة جاو جاو جاو
فلسطين عربية حرة غبية
That was the Palestinian version of the popular anti-fascist song Bella Ciao. This is Pacifica's Capitalism, Race, and Democracy. I'm Paulina Vasiliev. Thousands of trade unionists rallied for Palestine in Oakland, California, and New York City on Saturday, December 16th. In Oakland, SEIU 1021 steward Linda Curry Omile spoke about the struggle of Palestine and the fight in her local to overcome the bureaucracy's resistance to solidarity.
Thank you so much, little ones. I wish I brought my little ones here. They are the spirit and they are the soul of this. Honestly, this particular chapter of Palestinian struggle is based on the children and the absurd amount of children who have died in the last 2 months. So it is really great to be with you gathered here today in the fight for Palestinian liberation. I'm a Palestinian American who was born and raised in the Bay Area. Woo! Palestinian! I've been involved in Palestine activism my entire life, and I am exhilarated by the recent infusion of energy into the movement for Palestinian freedom and dignity. At the same time, I feel immense grief for the cost of these gains. The cost of unimaginable human suffering and thousands of Palestinian lives lost, over 40% of which are children. Again, children. Let that sink in. As union members and working class people in the United States, we have the unique opportunity to stop the war machine that is destroying families, robbing human beings of their dreams and futures, and that is planting the seeds of future conflict. We here today are joining the millions of people around the world, working class people, people who care about human rights, to send to the United States and Israel the message that the workers of the world are uniting against this atrocious genocide. We are here to send the message that labor does not accept the U.S. government using billions of our tax dollars to finance a genocide abroad instead of investing those much-needed dollars in our communities here at home. We know that in the workplace, our voices united give us the power when the boss wants to divide us up and put us down. We have to unite the same way outside of the workplace as well. In every hall of power, working people are having to struggle against political, academic, media, and cultural institutions just to put out a statement standing against genocide? That is ridiculous! Academic journals and media outlets are unilaterally censoring articles and stories exposing the truth. AIPAC and the Zionist lobby are working overtime to silence anyone who opposes their agenda. Boo! And our reactionary Congress is installing Zionists into leadership of prestigious universities, more than already exist today. The Israeli military is killing journalists in Gaza and in Lebanon. Let's not forget about our Lebanese brothers and sisters who are also experiencing this. 64 journalists have been killed since October 7th. This is a blatant violation of human rights law. Israel's bombing hospitals. As of today, over half of Gaza's 36 hospitals are non-functioning. Ooh. Israel's killing doctors and nurses. More than 200 medical personnel have been killed since the genocide started. They are polluting water. 97% of water in Gaza is considered unfit for human consumption. Shame! Absolutely shame. In just 2 months, they have displaced and made homeless a population double the size of San Francisco's. Instead of investing in the homeless population of San Francisco, they want to put our money to bomb children in Gaza. Disgusting. And then they bomb people fleeing for their lives, despite promising safe route. This is absolutely unacceptable, and we as labor reject this. Billionaires like Mark Zuckerberg and Elon Musk are manipulating their social media platforms to silence Palestinian voices and to hide these images from us. Ooh. But no matter how much they try to keep us in the dark, the light is breaking through the cracks. The world is seeing what is actually happening. The ultra-rich cannot contain the truth. They are losing the battle and they know it. They know that they cannot beat the 99% when we are united. We are the union of the working class and we cannot be divided. Workers in unions, you can get resolutions with our demands passed at your workplaces and at your union locals. More pressingly, we are empowered to bargain for the common good and implement boycott, divestment, sanction agreements at work, whether in contract bargaining or during midterm bargaining. For people who aren't in unions, keep hitting the streets in protest. Woo! Keep coming to public comment at your local government meetings to get resolutions passed. Pack the courtroom next week to show Brooke Jenkins that she cannot repress our free speech by criminalizing our protests. Have no doubt that the people in power see every single one of these statements and actions, and that's why they fight so hard to defeat them. And that's why they've been changing their tune to sound less and less pro-Israel every week. The people in power have to know that we demand, at the very minimum, an immediate ceasefire a permanent ceasefire, an end to U.S. military aid to Israel, and an end to the occupation and siege of Palestinian land by Israeli forces. Together, we can make this a reality. And I have one very exciting announcement for you. SEIU 10 to 1, my union, and many of the people here participated in nightly meetings and hard work, blood, sweat, and tears to prepare one of the strongest resolutions ever proposed in the history of the United States on Israel-Palestine. And just today, as we speak, our executive board, the highest body representing 60,000 members in Northern California, passed one of the strongest resolutions in the U.S. just this hour. Yes! So, everybody, get out there, get involved in their unions. They made it look like they weren't going to do it. They put every obstacle in front of us, but we put everything into it, and it passed, and I want everyone to go out there and do the same and be inspired by this resolution. Thank you all. Free Palestine!
That was SEIU 1021 steward Linda Curry Omile speaking to a mass labor rally in Oakland sponsored by Labor for Palestine. That was Puerto Rican musician Danny Rivera singing to the children of Palestine. This is Pacifica's Capitalism, Race, and Democracy. I'm Paulina Vasiliev. Next, Jewish American political scientist and activist Norman Finkelstein highlights what Israel set as their goals from the get-go and describes them as a recipe for genocide. Finkelstein was debating attorney Alan Dershowitz on the Piers Morgan Uncensored show.
Number one, what you seem to be describing as a new development, namely Israel's indiscriminate assaults in Gaza, that's hardly a new development, with all due respect to you.
I've lost the sound.
Israel from literally day one set out as its goals. So if I can quote, first of all, the defense minister, there will be no electricity, no food, no water, no fuel. Everything is closed. We are fighting human animals, and we are acting accordingly. Now, that was not directed at Hamas. That was directed at the entire population of Gaza. I think your listeners understand what is the consequence of denying a civilian population all water, all food, all fuel, and all electricity. It doesn't take a rocket scientist to figure out that that is a recipe for genocide. Number two, you quoted or you had on Douglas Murray, who made a distinction between what he called the deliberate targeting of civilians versus the indiscriminate targeting of civilians. Not to want to sound pedantic, but Israel's leading authority on international law is a fellow named Yoram Dinstein, who I'm sure Alan Dershowitz knows. And Mr. Dinstein, or Dr. Dinstein, he stated that there is no fundamental difference under international law between the deliberate targeting of civilians and the indiscriminate targeting of civilians. There is no substantive difference. Therefore, under international law, according to Yoram Dinstein, Israel is targeting the civilian population of Gaza. That's another indication from the get-go, not from yesterday, not from when it was revealed to President Biden, but from the get-go, Israel has been engaging in a genocidal war in Gaza. Now, the genocidal war takes various forms. Again, I'm going to cite you old quotes. So let's take Giora Eiland, who was the head of Israel's National Security Council, the equivalent of our CIA. And he said, quote, Israel needs to create a humanitarian crisis in Gaza. Gaza will become a place where no human being can exist. Now, I'm not here to try to persuade Mr. Dershowitz or Professor Dershowitz. I am here to try to enlighten your listeners. So I would like them to cogitate, to meditate over what does it mean to say Gaza will become a place where no human beings can exist. Mr. Eiland, the former head of the National Security Council, went on to say, severe epidemics in the south of the Gaza Strip will bring victory closer and reduce casualties among IDF soldiers. And then there is Mr. Netanyahu, the prime minister. Not on one occasion, not from the spur of the moment, but twice in national addresses to the nation, very soberly, Mr. Netanyahu said, remember what Amalek did to you. This is a war between the sons of light and the sons of darkness. Now, as Professor Dershowitz surely knows, because he attended Hebrew school, actually, he grew up just a few blocks from me, or I should say I grew up a few blocks from him because he's older. He surely knows that in the midst of a war, in a country that is schooled in the Bible, that when you say your enemy is Amalek, then you are calling for the destruction, the killing of every man, woman, and child. So with all due regard to Mr. Dershowitz, I have to say this issue of human shielding is totally beside the point because it doesn't even come into play in this particular situation. The orders from the get-go denying food, water, electricity, and fuel to the entire civilian population, the order from the get-go to turn Gaza into a place that is not able to sustain human life, the order from the get-go in this battle between the sons of light and the sons of darkness,
okay.
I repeat, I do not believe it requires a rocket scientist to figure out that from day one, which is to say two months ago, Israel has been waging a war of genocide in Gaza.
That was Norman Finkelstein speaking on the Piers Morgan Uncensored show. A recent example of Israel's targeting of civilians in Gaza was the killing by Israeli soldiers of three Israeli citizens who had been taken to Gaza as captives. The Israeli citizens had disrobed and were holding up a white flag, signaling they posed no threat to the Israeli soldiers. Author and activist Dr. Hatem Bazian has more.
Well, Israel kills three of the hostages, its own citizens. But that's not the story. This is not the first time, again, that Israel kills some of its own citizens. We know from the October 7th, the number of Israeli citizens and Israelis who were in the kibbutz were killed by Israeli fire. But this is actually a unique case in here. The story, initially, the Israeli military said it was an accidental death, that there were three hostages that they had their bodies. But then the story can develop further that the three hostages actually were shirtless, that they had a makeshift white flag as they walked out, and yet the Israeli military actually shot and killed them. The story in here is to speak about the rules of engagement that the Israeli soldiers and military had relative to Palestinians and relative to Gaza. As it seems, there's a total, complete abdication of any type of restrictions or limitation on the Israeli military, a complete disregard to international law, to the Fourth Geneva Convention of the Palestinians. The fact that they were actually carrying a white flag and yet they were shot at and killed indicate that the rules of engagement is almost to treat all Palestinian civilians, white flag or not, as a legitimate target and to kill them. We have already a number of cases where actually civilians in schools or in hospitals and so on were shot at. Number of total destruction visited upon Palestinian civilians. And we all saw the images of Palestinians being stripped of their clothes and walked around, paraded by the Israeli military. If there is a question to be asked in here for the Israeli military, the prime minister, and all those who are supporting them internationally, is to speak about their rules of engagement. When are they allowed to shoot and not to shoot? And how come a civilian holding a white flag, which is universally accepted as an indication of non-hostile activity, for actually recognizing and limiting any type of engagement? The Israelis have engaged when they have the notion of not allowing any of the Israelis to be taken hostage, but this is actually almost a reversal case. So we demand a full accountability and investigation of Israeli military rules of engagement and what are the directives that are given to them in Gaza. I do think we have an international criminal court investigation in here on the rules of engagement and why so many Palestinians have been killed.
That was author and activist Dr. Hatem Bazian speaking on his YouTube channel. Palestinian musician Ramzi Abu Redwan. This is Pacifica's Capitalism, Race, and Democracy. I'm Paulina Vasiliev. Somalia has suffered catastrophic floods, displacing between 1 and 2 million people and killing up to 100. In a recent video, Somalis wade through flooded streets and sleep and sell produce on the banks of floodwaters. Pacifica's Ann Garrison spoke to Somali-American software developer Jamal Abdullahi, who has joined fellow Somalis to fund a flood relief effort.
Jamal, why do you think this flooding happened?
Good question. There are a number of contributing factors that are both natural and man-made. El Nino certainly brings more rain, but equally important are the man-made factors. For example, both of Somalia's main rivers, Juba and Shabelle, start in the hinterlands of Ethiopia. Therefore, Somalia is considered a downstream from Ethiopia. Ethiopia builds dams that are out of compliance with international transboundary water rules. They often close dams during dry season, contributing to drought, then open it up during the main rainy season. leading to an uncertainty in normal volumes of water flowing downstream into Somalia. So El Nino combined with water from upstream are causing these catastrophic floods.
How bad do you think the ongoing damage will be?
Lack of robust land use management and infrastructure maintenance exacerbated the impact of the floods. For example, in the western region of Gedo, where the Jibril River zigzags through many communities, water has reached as high as 8 feet in some places. Two of the main three bridges have been completely washed away. The third one is hanging by a thread after being submerged into water for over a week. It will take a significant investment to reconstruct and repair some of these critical infrastructure, and it is an effort that Somalia is unable to afford. Also, farm crops and livestock have been completely destroyed. Some communities have seen waterborne diseases already. So the ongoing damage is significant and expected to last a long time.
And doesn't Somalia have a very weak state, barely more than a flag and a UN seat, that isn't capable of intervening?
That's probably the most accurate descriptions or characterizations that I heard about Somalia. But that's absolutely correct. Somalia is fractured. The government in Mogadishu, in the capital, is mired in a rampant corruption and nepotism. The current administration has been grossly incompetent and has politicized aid. Much of the aid has been stolen. Corrupt officials have also hindered efforts by the diaspora by demanding bribes.
Okay, the U.S. has a great deal to do with the weakness of the Somali state, doesn't it?
That is correct. Also, the U.S. left Somalia after the infamous Black Hawk Down incident in 1993, but it returned with an vengeance after the embassy bombings in Kenya and Tanzania in 1998. The U.S. used Ethiopia army as a proxy to overthrow the Islamic Courts Union in 2006, and that event led to the birth of Al-Shabaab, a brutal terror group which rules many parts of the country as we speak today. This was one of the most destabilizing events in Somalia since independence that has emerged as an extension of the United States' approach to Somalia.
Press and NGOs were quick to blame the flooding on global warming, as they do every time Somalia suffers extreme weather. What do you think of that?
Climate profiteering has become such a big business. Mega foundations and carbon credit brokers push narrative of the phenomena being the root cause of all evils in countries such as Somalia. And mainstream media has essentially become an echo chamber for the NGOs pursuing big donor money by blaming everything on global warming and climate change. But this narrative is extremely inaccurate when it comes to Somalia. While climate change is serious and deserves an immediate action, Somalia is not the climate change poster child that the climate profiteers would like us to believe. Many man-made factories contribute more to the misery than climate change.
Jamal, thank you for speaking to Pacifica Radio.
Good to be with you, Anne.
Sounds of Somalia, traditional Somali music. You're listening to Pacifica's Capitalism, Race, and Democracy. I'm your host, Paulina Vasiliev. In South America, the countries of Venezuela and Guyana are in disagreement over who has sovereignty over the Essequibo region, an oil and resource-rich area which Venezuela has claimed since its independence from Spain in 1824. Guyana, however, a former British colony, which only became an independent republic in 1970, contests Venezuela's claim. Guyana's claim to the Essequibo is based on a conference of colonial powers that in 1899, without Venezuela's consultation, decided the area belonged to the British. Tensions between these two South American countries increased after Venezuela held a referendum on December 3rd, when a decisive majority spoke out strongly in favor of protecting their nation's interests in the Essequibo. Since 2015, Guyana had already begun granting exploitation concessions in the region to transnational companies such as ExxonMobil. Last Thursday, Venezuelan President Nicolas Maduro and the President of Guyana, Irfan Ali, began talks in St. Vincent and the Grenadines aimed at easing tensions over the Essequibo. Prior to the face-to-face meeting, Maduro and Ali held separate meetings with the leaders of the member countries of the Community of Caribbean States, CARICOM, and the Community of Latin American and Caribbean States, CELAC. These regional institutions have been promoting dialogue between Venezuela and Guyana to avoid an escalation of the geopolitical conflict. Pacifica's Don DeBar has more.
I'm pleased that the Community of Latin America and Caribbean States and CARICOM have managed to take this step, and we are going to make the most of it so that our Latin America and the Caribbean will continue to be a zone of peace, or we have approved. It will be the victory of peace for our homeland Venezuela and for the great homeland as well.
That was Venezuela's President Nicolas Maduro arriving in St. Vincent and the Grenadines on Thursday for a meeting with his counterpart, the president of Guyana, to discuss some contested lands that lie between the two countries and are very rich in oil. For more on that, we're going to speak with Camila Escalante. Camila, give us a little background on this.
5 days later, after the announcement that Prime Minister of St. Vincent and the Grenadines, Ralph Gonsalves, came and held a press briefing saying that due to the ongoing controversy and how difficult the situation has become between the two countries, how tense things have become between Guyana and Venezuela, that he extended an invitation to host talks between the two presidents, President Nicolas Maduro and President Irfan Ali, in the St. Vicentian capital. And so that took place. It was brokered by CARICOM, and it's the head of CARICOM right now is Roosevelt Skerrett. And then Ralph Gonsalves came forward, not as the prime minister of St. Vincent and the Grenadines, but actually as the current president pro tempore of CELAC. And they also, the two presidents, were said to have requested the presence and mediation of Lula da Silva, the president of Brazil, who's also a neighbor to Guyana and Venezuela. He didn't come himself, but he sent his presidential advisor and very close advisor and friend on many important matters, who he has sent on many important delegations around the world, Celso Amorim. And so Celso was there at this meeting. You know, one of these presidents, President Nicolas Maduro, wants to define the borders and settle this dispute through a mechanism of diplomacy and talks here within the region. And the other, the president of Guyana, says that it's a closed dispute that has been decided on or needs to be decided on by the International Court of Justice. And Venezuela says that it doesn't recognize the jurisdiction of the ICJ on the matter. So it's very complicated. They're looking at a very difficult situation. Both of them say that they have a mandate, you know, within their parliaments, within their constitutions, that they each have to respect, and they can't just make decisions unilaterally without respect to those binding things within their own countries. And so the president of Guyana says that this is an issue of us deciding as a country that we want to go with the foreign investment and these business partnerships, selling our natural resources with foreign companies, in this case, Exxon. And, you know, ExxonMobil and Chevron and other companies have also invested and had operations in Venezuela. He says, what's so different about the situation in Guyana? And what, you know, the president of Venezuela and Venezuelans in general have said is that in the case of Guyana, they're not just selling their resources to foreign companies. It's that they've seen large U.S. presence in the region, that they're seeing large Southcom presence in the region, military exercises, advisors, delegations from the U.S. Congress, and other high-level trips on like a weekly basis in Guyana. So it's a country which Venezuela says Guyana is not a sovereign country. And that is the difference.
President Ali, as a matter of fact, sounded exactly like someone who was working for somebody else. Take a listen.
We made it very clear.
Eso lo aclaramos muy bien.
That Guyana is not the aggressor.
Que Guyana no es el agresor.
Guyana is not seeking war.
Guyana no busca la guerra.
But Guyana reserved the right to work with all our partners to ensure the defense of our country. All our partnership is based on the defense of our territorial integrity and our sovereignty.
And the president of Guyana arrived at these talks in Kingstown on a U.S. aircraft. It was a U.S. flag Raytheon Hawker 900 XP. And so, you know, Guyana is a small country, maybe doesn't have its own presidential aircraft, but many of its friends of CARICOM do. They have their own airlines, such as Lyot. So it's really interesting, you know, this sort of partnership that we're seeing between Guyana, which says it's this small country that has this history of colonialism. And he talks about the need for reparations of, you know, the victims of slavery. But at the same time, he's partnering with, you know, the empire right now to try to protect this territory, the Essequibo, which they say is theirs.
Yeah, I mean, we've got both ExxonMobil with their hand involved in this, and also his presentation after the first session. In essence, it sounded like he was invoking Southcom. I mean, he was talking about basically that our partners will partner with us to help us exploit our resources and defend our sovereignty.
Absolutely. They're saying that they're such a small country. It's a very small population. They don't have a very large military. Guyana says that its military there is for peace and defense. Venezuela would say the same thing. But obviously, the difference is that there's this huge foreign presence, not only of these multinational companies that exploit resources for their own profit, which they take out of the country, but they have that large military, foreign military presence. And they also have the presence of USAID and other NGOs in the country, which countries like Nicaragua, Cuba, Venezuela, and Bolivia have barred from entering their countries. In the case of Guyana, you know, they've pretty much set up shop all around the country and are really running things. And I think that's the distinction people are making. It's not to decide on behalf of anyone, you know, who this territory belongs to. But it is to say that Guyana right now is a country that is heavily under the influence or which has at least a very large and obvious U.S. presence, especially now that this issue has arisen again.
That meeting between the presidents of Venezuela and Guyana concluded at 4 p.m. local time in St. Vincent and the Grenadines. Both President Maduro and President Ali expressed their willingness, according to a report in Telesur, to continue the dialogue to resolve the conflict over the Essequibo territory. All right, Camilla, thank you so much.
Thank you, Don.
That was Pacifica's Don DeBar speaking to Nicaragua-based journalist Camila Escalante.
Que tú te levantes, América Latina obrera, no sé por qué no lo haces. El yanqui teme a la revolución, el yanqui teme grito, yanqui gojón, yanqui gojón. Y viene remontando el Amazonas, el grito rebelde del Carioca, y viene a unirse con su hermano, el obrero venezolano. América Latina obrera, América Latina obrera, América Latina.
That was Venezuelan musician and composer Ali Primera singing América Latina obrera. And that concludes today's edition of Capitalism, Race, and Democracy. We thank all of Pacifica's sister stations and affiliates who contribute to the production of this show. Today's program was produced by the Capitalism, Race, and Democracy Collective, with contributions from Steve Zeltzer, Ann Garrison, Don DeBar, and Freddy Libertad. You can find this and all previous episodes at our website, capitalismraceanddemocracy.org. Make sure you click the subscribe button. Follow us on X, formerly Twitter, at PacificaCRD. I've been your host, Paulina Vasiliev. Thanks for listening.